All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and today we have a very special show. We're once again going to be talking about the situation in Gaza, Palestine, and Israel, and the policies and actions of the Trump-Pence fascist regime. And we're going to be hearing two interviews with one of the world's foremost authorities on international law and international relations.
His name is Richard Falk. He's a former United Nations Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territories occupied since 1967. He taught at Princeton University for 40 years in UC Santa Barbara. He is the author and or co-author of over 20 books and editor of 20 more. This brother just doesn't ever stop working, okay? Over the years, he has been fighting tirelessly for the rights and lives of the Palestinian people and standing up to nonstop attacks from the Zionists, their allies, and their backers in the U.S.
At the back end of the show, we're going to hear a conversation we had last year on the Trump-Pence regime's decision to move the U.S. Embassy in Israel to the occupied city of Jerusalem. We'll explore the illegality of the move under international law and go into the motivations of the U.S. rulers to go to new depths in supporting and encouraging their Israeli enforcers in the Middle East and the danger this poses to the region and the world. And right now, we'll listen to an interview we did just last week on the Great March of Return in Gaza and the latest Israeli crimes against humanity.
I'm really pleased to welcome to the show Richard Falk. Richard, welcome.
Glad to be with you once more.
Yes. Yes, me too, man. Well, let's jump into this because we got so much to talk about. Let's open up with this. The Great March of Return. I want to talk about that a little and the significance of that march and the Israeli response to it. Now, you said that it has reached a new level of moral, political, and legal wretchedness in Israel. And I wanted to, you know, sort of pin that in with the idea, with the sort of counterpose that to this Great March of Return and the significance of it.
Well, I think it is a milestone in the Palestinian narrative of resistance over this horrendously long period of victimization and suffering. And it coincides with an Israeli sense that they can get away with whatever they want to do because they have their man in the White House and they can avoid any kind of censure or even in fact-finding inquiry that they, in other words, have a kind of green light to engage in criminal activity of the most cruel variety. I mean, shooting not only unarmed protesters and demonstrators at the Gaza border, but apparently targeting medical personnel, journalists, anyone that was trying to assist and posed no remote threat to Israeli security. The whole demonstration could have been handled as a crowd control challenge, and there was no excuse whatsoever for relying on live ammunition, which was used against 3,400 Palestinians. Quite astonishing number, just that single number in a demonstration. So this is a exposure both of Israeli mentality toward the Palestinian people and of the determination of the Palestinians to resist, to continue to resist, to try to convey to the world the dreadful conditions under which they're living and their long failure to have their most basic rights respected.
You know, Richard, when we talk about this, though, and you think about all that, and the eruption of the violent assault in Gaza and the role of Israel in this, including the Israeli justification of its actions as the right of every country to defend itself, that's something I think people really have to take into consideration, because a lot of people think, okay, there's what's happening with Israel, and then there's what's happening with those damn people in Gaza, and then there's all the Palestinians altogether. And what, you know, what ends up happening is Israel keeps being able to just say, look, we're just trying to keep the peace. We're just trying to keep things in control. And yet what that means, really, what it's meant for people is the demonization and the terrorism and the slaughter of so many people in both mentally and physically.
Yeah, exactly. And you put it very well. And I think the Israeli move now, particularly coinciding with the opening of the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem, another provocative act, is an effort to break the Palestinian will to resist and to, in effect, declare that the conflict is over and that Israel has won. See, I think the Israeli subtext for all of what they did, which was, as I say, both unnecessary and did inflict a kind of public relations defeat on Israel throughout the world. It did generate sympathy for the Palestinians. It probably strengthened the BDS campaign and other initiatives. It certainly generated a great deal more sympathy for the Palestinian ordeal. So you have to ask, why would the Israelis, understanding this, still go ahead with this disproportionate violence and the attacks on innocent people? And the only thing that makes some sense is that they want to convey this sense that if the Palestinians don't surrender, they will face even worse massacres. I think that's the message. And you know Daniel Pipes, who's a kind of prominent arch-Zionist who runs the Middle East Forum, has been organizing the so-called Victory Caucus, saying that negotiations and diplomacy have failed to solve the conflict. The only way it will end is if Israel wins and the Palestinians lose. That's the way wars end, and this is the way Israel should proceed. It shouldn't seek further negotiations. It shouldn't seek a diplomatic settlement. It should seek a victory. And how do you get a victory in this kind of situation? The only way is by creating so much fear and so much suffering that there is an eventual either abandonment of the struggle or actual dispossession again of the Palestinians. It's hard to know what the end game will be, but it's something along these lines that's in the mind of the Israeli leaders and of the strongest right-wing Zionist supporters in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things just along that, and I wanted to speak to this a little bit, because you've also brought up, and this is something that I don't think a lot of people know, and I know I had to think about it for a while, and you bring up about the demonization of Hamas. Now, I'm not a big fan of Hamas in terms of its religious fundamentalism and the rest of this stuff, but it's, Hamas is actually, it isn't like it just appeared and just bam, it's like sort of there, and it's this evil, group with everybody's, mouths dripping blood. You've mentioned that actually, historically, Hamas has had a relationship with the U.S. and, in a certain sense, it's had a relationship that is very, just it's the opposite of what actually it's been accused of. That it's actually looked for ways to sort of work with Israel and work with the U.S. And now it's being demonized as part of actually creating the okay for doing what's being done to the Palestinian people.
Yes, it certainly has committed its own share of inhuman acts over time, but it's been in a situation where it was encouraged back in 2006 to adopt a political approach and abandon what they were calling armed struggle at the time, and it was persuaded to enter the elections. But what wasn't anticipated was that it would win the election. And once it won the elections, and it was the U.S. that tried to induce it to enter the electoral process and adopt a political strategy instead of a military strategy. But Israel didn't want that, and it didn't want the long-term ceasefire offers that were repeatedly put forward by Hamas leaders. I've talked to Hamas leaders, both in Doha and Cairo. And I found them quite both intelligent, well-educated, and seeking some kind of accommodation over a long period of time. And it has been a failure of U.S. diplomacy, or you can put it differently, that it's again shows the subservience of Washington to Israel when it comes to dealing with Hamas, that they won't allow them to escape from this terrorist box. And as long as they're kept in the terrorist box, Israel is free to do anything it wants. And it just paints any kind of political Palestinian initiative as a Hamas undertaking, which in this case, for instance, is completely false. This great march was organized by a whole range of NGOs and political organizations within Gaza. Of course, Hamas supported it, and many of its own supporters participated in it, but that it didn't mean that it became an armed assault on Israel, which it never was. It was a large-scale demonstration with some symbolic acts of violence that were, as I say, mainly symbolic. They inflicted no casualties. There was it was as one-sided as a encounter could be, and to use high-powered sniper rifles against such demonstrators is a war crime, in my view.
Mm-hmm. That's really extremely important. I'm going to get right back to that. I have to let listeners know that we're talking with Richard Falk, and Richard is an international law and international relations scholar and former United Nations Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territories occupied since 1967. Richard, you've talked about this as well. You know, this whole idea of, you know, look, on all the major issues, international law is actually on the side of the Palestinians, if you just look at it on the paper. But then when it comes to the reality, you have all these international crimes by Israel, and you say that the policies and practices of Israel towards the Palestinian people as a whole satisfy the requirements of the international crime of apartheid. And I know you and I both have had a lot of experience around the crime of apartheid in South Africa, and I kept thinking about this in relation to this. No matter what they say about, oh, they're trying, there's actually international crimes being committed by Israel that relate to the annihilation or the extinguishing of the Palestinian people. And when you talk about that as the international crime of apartheid, I wanted people to understand that. It's really important, I think, for people to see what's happening there.
Yes, I think it's the correct way of perceiving it. It's not the same as what was done in South Africa, because in South Africa there was a white minority population that made no pretension of having a kind of constitutional democracy or the rule of law. Israel is a more sophisticated version in two ways. One is that it has divided the Palestinian people in such a way as to subjugate them in different forms in different settings. So in other words, Gaza is one reality, the West Bank is another, the minority within Israel is a third, the refugees that are not allowed to return to their own homes are a fourth. And so you have these domains within which Palestinian subjugation takes place, but in different forms. And the overall objective is to impose a Jewish state on a non-Jewish society. That's the original, what I would call the original sin of Zionism, was this idea that the biblical entitlement that Jews had, because once they lived and controlled Palestine, allowed them to displace the people that were living there with no backing from either international law or the organized international community. In that sense, these structures of domination were essential to deal with what would inevitably turn into Palestinian resistance. In this post-colonial period, no people are going to accept the fact that a foreign ethnicity is going to run their own society. And so resistance is built into the whole dynamic, and domination is the only way of subjugating those who are resisting. So it's a vicious cycle that is without any solution other than some willingness to share the land and to dismantle the structures of apartheid that have been established over now 70 years.
Mm-hmm. Just following up on that, on all the we've talked about this a little, but on all the major issues, the international law is strongly on the side of the Palestinian people. If you're looking at just international law and what it says, what's been actually hammered out there and what people are supposed to be following in various parts of the world, whether that always held up or not is another question. But then you have, you look at that, and that next to what was happening in Jerusalem and the whole idea that the celebratory events, let's just talk about the celebratory events in relation to that in Jerusalem as the Palestinian people were literally being slaughtered in mass. I mean, it was just like, it was horrifying.
Yes, and then the juxtaposition of that celebratory event and the massacre at the Gaza border just 40 kilometers away typifies the double pathological reality that is now being enacted, and with the full approval and endorsement of the U.S. government.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's jump into this, because then you have this recent move of moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. What that has to do with all this in terms of the Israeli regime, in terms of the Palestinian people, the significance of moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. Let's talk about that.
Well, I think the first thing to say is that just as I said, you have to ask why did Israel do what it did in confronting this great march, you have to ask, why does Trump do this, which is a clearly provocative act, not only toward the Palestinians, but toward America's closest allies, the Europeans and others around the world. And I think it's basically domestically driven, that this was something that would please the Christian Zionists and their interest in promoting a kind of ultimate solution to the whole issue of how Jesus returns to the world and reaches the final judgment. You have that pressure that's part of Trump's base, and the other part is the billionaire donors like Adelson and a couple of others. And so I think it was domestically driven, and with a real indifference toward what the world thought or what impact it would have on the region. And it is something, again, that is defiant of international law and of the international peace-oriented consensus that has kept alive this notion that there will be someday a Palestinian state and that the two states can coexist in historic Palestine.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things, just on that again, when you're looking at that, and you brought up this thing about bringing together this like juggernaut of all the various Christians, the Christian fundamentalists from around the world who are actually, looking at what's happening in Israel, and especially what's happening in relation to, Jerusalem and all that right now. And you're bringing together that plus the, the whole regime, the whole existence of what's going on, what has been going on with the Palestinian people in relation to Israel, in relation to the Zionists. So you're bringing together these Zionists who are about the state of Israel, and this is, then you have the blanket that covers it all of the U.S. imperialists and what their view and what they're trying to do in the world. So I'd like to just hear your thoughts on this, the bringing together of these Christian fascists and the Israeli fascists.
Yes, it's a very strange kind of convergence in a way, because the Christian Zionists, among other things, and they're very powerful and quite numerous and particularly influential in states where not many Jews live, so they add significantly to the leverage that AIPAC and Jewish lobbying groups have. And their essential idea is that once all the Jews return to Israel, Jesus will return and the final judgment will occur. So it's a funny mixture of a kind of anti-Semitism, because you want the Jews out of the diaspora and to leave wherever they are, including the U.S., of course, and at the same time to create a situation in Israel where, unless the Jews then convert to Christianity, they will be damned forever, sent to hell. So that it's a very garbled reading of the Book of Revelations, which is the final book of the New Testament. And this comes together with this Trumpist foreign policy that seems to go along with a very dangerous confrontation with Iran at the present time that could easily escalate into a regional war, and is a breaking of the very carefully negotiated agreement on Iran's nuclear program that involved, again, the other members of the other permanent members of the Security Council plus Germany, and was seen as a diplomatic breakthrough when it occurred in 2014, now is really a crisis point, a flashpoint in geopolitics. And we really have no reason with people like Bolton and Pompeo in these positions of being chief advisors to a man that doesn't understand the world very well, and to the extent he does, he thinks he can bluff his way into an indefensible position. So it's a crazy situation that's filled with dangers, and as you say, you said at the outset, apocalyptic kind of dangers, because if the situation really gets out of control, it's unimaginable how it could escalate into a nuclear confrontation of some sort.
Mm-hmm. Now, I was very impressed with something you said in defining all this. You said it comes down to America first, the world last. And I think that really is really important. And I wanted to actually, we're going to have to wrap this up real quick, though, now. And I wanted to ask you one final question, that the conflict over, here's the situation. I think people get too comfortable, and I think they need to actually look at what's happening. And I wanted to pose to you this question. Are we actually looking at a potential genocide regarding the Palestinian people in the making in Gaza, in Palestine?
Well, I think it's not an easy question to give a short answer to, because genocide is a moral, political, and legal kind of characterization. And there's no question that the political and moral tendencies of what Israel is doing is clearly genocidal. But to make it a legal genocide, the kind of genocide that is an international crime, requires some kind of proof of a deliberate intention. And I don't think there have been some statements by the Israeli Minister of Justice. Lieberman has made statements to the effect that there's no such thing as an innocent Palestinian. So there's definitely genocidal sparks, but I don't think there's the kind of evidence that would responsibly support a allegation of genocide as an international crime, in contrast to what I do believe is an international crime, and that is the apartheid structures that are imposed upon the Palestinian people as a whole. I think that is, there is real evidence of intentionality and of criminality with regard to apartheid, but it would be premature, and hopefully never will come to that, to allege the crime of genocide.
And people need to actually make sure that it doesn't come to that. So, Richard, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, it's, as always, it's a great pleasure to talk with you.
Same here, Richard.
And I wish you good success in your very important program.
All right. Thank you very much, Richard. Talk to you again soon. Take care.
Take care, Michael.
Bye. All right. We've just been talking with Richard Falk. Richard is an incredible, incredible human being, okay? And he's an international law and international relations scholar and the former United Nations Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territories occupied since 1967. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned.
Tales from the dark side, evidence of the settlements on my hard drive. Man, I swear my heart died at the end of that car ride. When I saw that checkpoint, welcome to apartheid. Soldiers wear military green at the checkpoint. Automatic guns, that's machine at the checkpoint. Tables not M16s at the checkpoint. Fingers on the trigger, you'll get leaned at the checkpoint. Little children, grown adults and teens at the checkpoint. All your papers better be clean at the checkpoint. Gotta put your finger on the screen at the checkpoint and pray that red light turns green at the checkpoint. And Martin Luther King had a dream of the checkpoint. He wake with loud screams from the scenes at the checkpoint. Is Malcolm X by any means at the checkpoint? Imagine if your daily routine was the checkpoint.
And Martin Luther King had a dream of the checkpoint. He wake with loud screams from the scenes at the checkpoint. Is Malcolm X by any means at the checkpoint?
All right, that was Jasiri X with Checkpoint. Now let's hear more from Richard Falk, this time from a conversation that took place last year, shortly after the Trump regime's announcement that it would move its embassy in Israel to the city of Jerusalem.
All right, Richard, I wanted to talk to you about this first question because it's come up really hard-hitting in the last week or so. Trump's announcement that the U.S. is going to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and is going to move its diplomatic embassy to the city of Jerusalem. Now, he's justified this by saying that Israel is the only country in the world that is not allowed to locate its capital in a national city of its own choice. What's the problem here, Richard?
Well, there are a number of problems. For one thing, there's an international consensus that Trump's announcement broke to the effect that no change in the status of Jerusalem would be made until the parties themselves, in other words, Israel and Palestine, reached an agreement as to how they would share control over the city. And that was understood to be something that would be deferred until the last stages of a supposed peace negotiation. So that's one aspect of what's wrong and disruptive about it. The other is the fact that Israel is trying to establish a capital in an occupied territory is basically not its own territory. The assumption being made by the Israeli assertion is that Jerusalem as a totality is part of Israel. But the whole international law understanding of the status of Jerusalem is that it is not resolved as to its proper legal status, and in the interim, it's occupied territory, at least so far as East Jerusalem is concerned. And the whole of Jerusalem is in a kind of legal abeyance. So that you have two big problems there.
Mm-hmm. When you're talking about this, I kept thinking, well, okay, but there's this relationship, or what is the relationship between this and what you're saying and the fact that Israel has no problem at all making this move that it decided to make and that they did it years ago. They actually, decades ago, stated their intention to actually make the capital Jerusalem. But now there's this whole thing that's developed where they have the sanction of the big dog in the world, the U.S. imperialists. And there's this whole question of the relationship between what they've decided to do and the fact that Israel has no problem doing it, since it actually has refused. I mean, it's actually refused to define its borders. It's probably the only country in the world that has refused to define its borders in all these decades.
Yes, exactly, because there's the tension between Israel as a established political entity and the ambitions of Israel to satisfy the maximal Zionist vision of biblical Israel, which extends at least to the West Bank and the whole of Jerusalem. So there's always been that tension, and Israel has cleverly avoided committing itself publicly to this vision of a greater Israel, which is a direct confrontation with the international consensus, and to the establishment of its own legitimacy back in 1948, when it was accepted as an independent state on the basis of General Assembly Resolution 181, which was a division of the territory of mandated Palestine between the Palestinians and the Israelis, and even at that time was considered by the Arab world and certainly by the Palestinians to be a highly unfair territorial allocation.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm going to ask you a little bit more about 181 soon, but I wanted to follow up on this a little bit, because part of the thing that I see around this, or that I, as I was reading it and studying it, I kept thinking, well, wait a minute, you know, they've refused to define their borders for purposes of international law. And it's sort of like they've basically said, all right, to hell with this. We don't have to pay attention to what's going on in relation to, you know, what international law is. And they do have a sort of a history of saying international law, screw that. Doesn't apply to us. And it's also tied
well,
in...
Well, screw that, except, Michael, when it's on our side.
Right. Go ahead, in other words,
Israel can be very legalistic if they think law favors their position or what they're advocating, and they constantly are asserting the kind of legal arguments to justify, for instance, their attacks on Gaza and their claims of self-defense, which are factually very vulnerable to criticism, but at least rest on a coherent legal argument. So they use law very opportunistically, much like the U.S. itself. But going back to your earlier point, the way in which Israel has been able to project its effective control over Jerusalem is a geopolitical one in which it was content with U.S. ambiguity, that it would support Israel in terms of its own extension of control. But until Trump, it would adhere to the international consensus that the legal future and political future of Jerusalem would be determined by negotiations, by diplomacy, between the two parties. And why this decision is seen as a rupture and a repudiation of this long-standing international understanding is that it looks like a way of affirming Israel's determination to have an endgame to the conflict imposed by its unilateral edict or decree. In other words, to abandon diplomacy and not even pretend that it's interested in a negotiated solution.
Yeah, and that leads me into this question, because I remember speaking to you over the years and reading things that you've written and then studying the situation in general. There is this particular importance in relation to the West Bank and how Israel views that. And it's very much, and it's also true, I guess you'd have to say about Gaza too, when you look at the seemingly never-ending attacks on Gaza, that it's very much bordering on the denial of the existence of Palestine and the Palestinian people, Palestine as a legitimate state, and the Palestinian people as a legitimate people.
No question. I mean, that's the from the very beginning, see, it's not really the puzzle challenging Zionism was, how do we get rid of the Palestinian majority? remembering that when the Balfour Declaration 100 years ago was issued, the Jewish population of Palestine was no more than 6% at the most. And even at the end of World War II, when the partition resolution was adopted, the Jewish population of Palestine was only 33%. And to make Israel fulfill the Zionist vision of a democratic and Jewish state meant they had to establish a Jewish majority. And the only way they could do that was to get rid of most of the Palestinians. And the so-called Nakba, or dispossession of the Palestinians that occurred in the 1947-48 war, achieved that result. But it's been a continuous process of how do we deal with this demographic so-called ticking bomb without repudiating our legitimacy claims that rest on being a liberal democracy. And increasingly, as they move toward this unilateral end of the conflict, they've abandoned any serious claim of being a democratic state as distinct from a kind of ethnocratic state. It's clearly intended to be a Jewish state, and the idea of democracy and human rights is definitely subordinated, and that's why we concluded in our UN study that Israel's structure of control over the Palestinian people as a whole really rested on apartheid structures of victimization and subjugation based on ethnic identity.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that, and I spent a lot of time studying apartheid in South Africa and had written about it, had gone there when it was an apartheid state and interviewed all kinds of people about the situation. And one of the things that struck me, though, is in terms of, like I was just thinking as you're talking about, you know, this point about how Israel has reacted to or acted upon the Palestinian people. It's true that there's a lot in common there, which we should talk about now, I guess, actually, the point about you've talked about apartheid in South Africa and how it applies to Israel and the Palestinian people. But I also think that there is this element of, I mean, it's sort of like ethnic cleansing in a certain sense that they've done with the Palestinian people, where they don't need the Palestinian people and they don't really want them. And so this whole thing has been unleashed.
And they've struck, and in that sense, it's very different because the South African economy was premised on cheap African labor.
Mm-hmm.
Israel has deliberately not wanted to base its economic viability on Palestinian labor for precisely the reasons you suggest, that they want to get rid of as many Palestinians as possible. And ethnic cleansing is the gentlest accurate word for what happened in 1947-48, which meant the expulsion of 700,000 to 750,000 Palestinians and the denial of any right of return, regardless of how deep the connections of the Palestinians were with the land and with family and other connections.
Yeah, and that leads to something, too, though, that, which is really, I mean, it's really important in terms of people understanding this, because then all of a sudden, and what you've pointed to this and you started to speak to it a little bit earlier, but you've pointed to it in other places as well. You've pointed to the importance of actually people going into history to understand the violation that Israel and in some ways the U.S. is carrying out in relation to or in this new recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, that there's much more happening there than simply the, and it is interesting because there's a certain bowing down to the Christian fascists in this country, you know, sort of personified by Pence and all the people that's sort of wide-eyed and happy they were to find out that this was going to happen, that Jerusalem, the capital, was going to be in Jerusalem. You know, but you've also got this whole...
That's a very good point, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And then you've also got this whole thing about what they've done where the, you know, where in terms of this new recognition of Jerusalem as the capital, that you've compared it to General Assembly Resolution 181 from the United Nations, and I thought that was actually really important for people to talk about. So maybe we could hit on both of those points.
Yes, well, see, one of the things that's interesting about this decision is that it joins the kind of unilateralist foreign policy that Trump champions, which is was epitomized perhaps by the withdrawal from the Paris Climate Change Agreement, being the only country of 193 that repudiates this seminal experiment in international cooperation to solve a common global problem. So you have on the one side this unilateralism, ignoring international cooperative arrangements and structures, and on the other hand, you have this double policy domestically, satisfying Zionist donors like Sheldon Adelson and satisfying Christian evangelists like Mike Pence, and at the same time serving the interests of class-based politics associated with Wall Street and the financial world. These two domestic and international vectors of Trump's policy converge in this Jerusalem issue.
Yeah, yeah. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Richard Falk. Richard is a former United Nations Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territories occupied since 1967. He's also an American Professor Emeritus of International Law at Princeton University. Now, how does this General Assembly Resolution 181 fit into things? Because that actually, it seems fairly important to understand that, what it is and how it fits into this whole scenario.
Well, it fits in, again, in at least two ways. One is that Israel's own legitimacy as a state is premised on the partition resolution that was adopted in 1947 and served as the basis of Israel's admission to the UN a year later. And secondly, it disposes of Jerusalem as belonging to neither Jews nor the non-Jewish communities in Palestine, but as an internationalized city under UN administration. And the notion here was that this particular city with its religious symbolism and so on should not be part of the partition arrangement. So there was, in a sense, a territorial denial in the very foundation of Israel's own legitimacy from a UN point of view that took place as soon as Israel in 1967 took over the whole of Jerusalem militarily and immediately enlarged, you know, doubled its area by Israeli law, and then declared it to be the unified eternal city of the Jewish people.
Boy, tell me this.
So 181 is very, very fundamental, I think, to a correct understanding of the evolution of the conflict and relation to Jerusalem as a particular place.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That's actually what I was thinking is when I started to speak there, is that it is very much part of that. And when you see that, you know, in terms of including what you were talking about, just what the resolution actually said, but then you actually have to talk about this new development. And in some ways it is a new development, and in some ways it isn't, where you have Israel has been pretty open about what it's doing today in relation to Jerusalem. And that actually even went back to 1980, where they actually were pretty open about, look, this is going to be our capital city. You don't like it. Tough.
Yes, but they were saying that, but even the U.S. refused to endorse that. See, and what's different now is that the Trump diplomacy, such as it is an unconditional endorsement of what Israel was unilaterally proclaiming ever since 1967, essentially.
Yeah, that's what I was going to get into with you. I really wanted to hear your thoughts on that, because it does seem like, you know, look, the U.S. Congress, I mean, they even passed an act that, what was it, the Jerusalem Embassy Act. If, you know,
yes.
People were just thinking about it now, but actually the U.S. Congress in the 90s passed this, the Jerusalem Embassy Act, which basically recognized Jerusalem as Israel's capital back then.
Yes, and that's another interesting dimension of all of this, that the Congress was basically playing domestic politics because they didn't try to tie the executive's hand, and they always connected it to U.S. security and other considerations. But they wanted at the same time to please the Zionist and pro-Israeli lobby and so on. And this was a good symbolic way of doing that without paying any cost. And it shows domestically how much the Palestinians have suffered because they had no countervailing power to the Israeli well-organized and well-funded lobbies. And you get a very distorted policy, national policies, whenever you have that kind of one-sidedness on the domestic political scene, and an issue is very fundamental for an influential ethnic or religious group within American society.
What do you mean by that one-sidedness?
Well, what I mean is that you have no, for instance, in the relationship to Greek wishes with respect to the Aegean, there was always, or with Cyprus is a better example, Greek aspirations with regard to Cyprus were always balanced by U.S. concerns about NATO and preserving a positive relationship with Turkey. And so even though it's the domestic scene was favorable to the Greek pressures, they were always neutralized by this strategic interest in keeping Turkey from being too unhappy. Same thing with the Armenian issue.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell me this. You said, and I'm trying to really figure this out because I know that there's all this, you know, you've spent a lot of your life actually digging into this and really speaking out in ways that were extremely important in exposing this. And international law, I read somewhere where international law says that East Jerusalem is occupied territory. And therefore,
yes,
whatever is done in relation to it is subject to the Fourth Geneva Convention. But it appears that it's not really, you know, that doesn't seem to matter anything to anybody.
Well, what you're really saying indirectly is that geopolitics trumps, and that's a bad...
It's good.
bad pun, trumps international humanitarian law. And that when there's a sufficiently strong geopolitical move, the U.S. and other countries push international law to one side, and that happens particularly in relation to security issues and war-peace issues. Doesn't happen so much in commercial trade investment issues or maritime safety and a whole series of things where international law works pretty well. It doesn't work well where hard power is part of the nexus of the problem or the core of the problem. And that's been the case in all of these territorial conflicts. And the Zionist movement and Israel as a state has been very opportunistic in the way in which it's disguised its real goals and pursued them stage by stage. You know, going back again to the Balfour Declaration, where they were only aspiring to achieve a homeland within the established entity of Palestine, of which they were a small minority, as I said earlier, to then wanting to be a state in accordance with the partition conception, to then wanting to be a state that could encroach upon the occupied Palestinian territory and become a state that was larger than what was envisioned either by partition or by the end of the so-called War of Independence in 1948. So at every stage, Israel has escalated its real demands beyond what its public posture had been at an earlier stage.
Mm-hmm. And tell me this.
And that makes it extremely difficult for the ordinary person to understand the progression and escalation of Israeli ambitions, because they weren't publicly visible. The full extent of them were not publicly visible until very recently. And now, with the green light given by the Trump administration, they've become more and more visible.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Now, tell me this. You know, there's a point here that this idea, I guess, that it poses a question, that, and I think you've posed this question yourself, that does any state actually really have the right to establish its capital in a city that's occupied, or in a territory that's occupied, that is actually occupied, is not, you know, and is recognized as occupied, you know, across the world and through the bitter experience of the people who live there?
The short answer to the first question is, of course not. Imagine if East Germany or the Soviet Union had extended Berlin to include a significant part of West Berlin. There would be World War III.
Mm-hmm.
See, and they were both occupied portions of a once unified and again now unified city. But the whole notion of occupation is incompatible with claiming territorial rights in that political entity that is, by international understanding, occupied.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly, exactly.
And by being occupied means it's not subject to sovereign control. And to have a capital city presupposes complete sovereign control. You've never heard of a capital in a place where the sovereign government didn't have plenary legal, political, and cultural control.
Yeah, right. Right, exactly. Good point. Yeah. Well, tell me this, because, and this is related to that. So then out of this situation, there actually has been a campaign that's kind of going on over the years to not just verbally, and I know this is something you've really delved into, but to not just verbally, but physically, actually physically do away with the Palestinian population in whatever means was necessary.
Yeah, but do away has been somewhat ambiguously implemented and may mean different things to different strands of the Israeli leadership. One meaning of do away is to effectively subjugate, whether the Palestinians are treated as a minority, discriminated minority in Israel, or as a captive population in Gaza, or as an insecure residents of Jerusalem, or as a occupied West Bank, or as permanent consignment to refugee or involuntary exile status. So one whole sense of what it means to get rid of the Palestinians is to subjugate and effectively control. The other, which is overlaps with this, is to seek to avoid a demographic ambiguity by the growth of Palestinian population, by actually physically getting rid of Palestinians to the extent possible. And one of the ways this is currently being considered within Israel is to somehow get rid of Gaza as part of the Palestinian entity and persuade either Egypt or Jordan to absorb and administer Gaza either as part of their own territories or as some sort of protectorate within their territory. This effort has so far failed, but it's indicative of this effort to combine, on the one side, ethnic cleansing with, on the other side, complete subjugation.
Yeah, and I think you just answered the last question I was going to ask you, which was where do things stand now in the wake of the Trump machine and what it's doing? And I think this point about, look, it's a very bad situation for the Palestinian people. It's a very bad situation for people all around the world who, if we allow that to happen, if we allow what they're doing to happen, if there's not a massive wave of opposition to this, both inside Israel, inside the, you know, the Palestinian territories, all of this, and inside here, where actually, you know, the Trump is actually the first president to actually not talk about the doing this, but to actually do it, and what it means in terms of the world. It's a terrible escalation of the rule of U.S. imperialism around the world, and the suffering of people in in Palestine, the Palestinian people, but also what it means to people all over the world, who we lose some of our own humanity if we stand there and just allow yet another genocidal assault to go on.
No, I completely agree with you, Michael. I mean, it's a precedent for that precisely that kind of unilateral geopolitical militarism or iron fist geopolitics, where law and morality are completely marginalized, and a bunch of calculations have been made. See, I think two of the things that are different in the Trump presidency is, first of all, intensifying these dysfunctional special relationships that pre-existed Trump with Israel and Saudi Arabia. And secondly, this pandering in an even more extreme way to the major Israeli donors within the United States and the Christian Zionists who have somehow wrapped up their own expectations of the second coming of Jesus with the transcendence of Israel as a renewed biblical state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. All right, Richard, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, as ever, I enjoyed it, Michael, and your questions led to a very good conversation.
Yeah, and I really enjoyed talking with you, man. And we'll do it again soon, all right?
Great.
All right, Richard,
take care.
You too, man. Bye now.
Bye.
All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with Richard Falk. Richard is the former United Nations Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territories occupied since 1967. He's also an American professor emeritus of international law at Princeton University, and he's also held a position at UC Santa Barbara. And we've been talking with Richard about what's the significance of Trump's announcement that the U.S. will now recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. What does it mean for the Palestinian people? All right, we're running up on our time, so I want to be real quick with this, but I want to make sure that I thank everyone that helped make this show possible today. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my board op, Teddy Robinson, and all of you who tune in each and every week and stay tuning in. And if you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. All right, we're going to go out now with a piece from Michael Hart called We Will Not Go Down, Song for Gaza.
A blinding flash of white light lit up the sky over Gaza tonight. People running for cover, not knowing whether they're dead or